This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Welcome to Story Smack. This is episode 67 of Story Smack, a podcast about stories and storytellers in the world of pop culture. My name is A.B. Sigler, audiobook narrator and founding partner at Empty Set Entertainment.
And my name is Scott Sigler, number one New York Times bestseller. And of course, you knew I was going to say this. There was a firefight!
Oh, I love this terrible movie so much. I love it. So we are obviously here to talk about the Boondock Saints. But before we do that, I would like to bring on the Empty Set movie maven, Rob Otto. Rob, how are you?
Oh, my gosh, and begotten. Look at that fine Irish lass. I couldn't possibly talk the whole time like this. Couldn't do it. Not.
But they are always after me, Lucky Charms. It's my favorite.
It's true.
Favorite from Austin Powers. Why are they always laughing at that? All right, baby, let's go. Let's hit it.
All righty. So as I mentioned, this is Story Smack, where we talk about things in the world of pop culture. And this week, we're discussing the 1999 movie, The Boondock Saints. As ever, FDO, can you give us the movie man intro?
I sure can. Tired of crime overrunning the streets of Boston, Irish Catholic twin brothers Connor and Murphy are inspired by their faith to cleanse their hometown of evil with their own brand of zealous vigilante justice. As they hunt down and kill one notorious gangster after another, they become controversial folk heroes in the community. But Paul Smecker, an eccentric FBI agent, is fast closing in on their blood-soaked trail. There you go.
Already, I have to point out, really, really, Paul Smecker got through? Really?
What do you mean got through?
Paul Smecker? Really? Small Pecker? Really? Are you kidding me?
Oh, holy crap. That is the first time I ever made that connection
right
there.
That is not true. That is not true.
That is 100% true.
I didn't know it either. I've never heard that before.
How is that possible?
Small Pecker, no way.
Every time anybody says Paul Smecker, I'm like, damn, I can't believe they got that past the MPAA.
Wow. That's impressive. Seeing as Rob and I go way back, we're high school buddies, and we have made a career out of finding ways to turn common words into to naughty words. Mm-hmm. And I never got Small Pecker before in my life.
And to always make as many small penis jokes against the other as humanly possible. How do we miss
now
that?
You have like, one
well,
more.
I feel bad.
I don't know.
I know you guys go once a year on a boys trip, most often to Vegas, sometimes yep. other places. Mm-hmm. The next time you're allowed to do that, one, I expect you to do it, and two, I expect you to make a reservation at a restaurant in Mr. Smecker's name, just
yes.
for me.
Yes, I will absolutely do that. But getting back to our Small Pecker movie, baby, what? Why don't you tell me about the box office of this, my favorite
this is
part.
So if you are coming into this this show listening blind or watching blind, having not seen the movie or don't know much about it, I will tell you that this movie, I cannot tell you enough how absolutely terrible it did at the box office and how absolutely terrible. And there's legs to it. There's a long tail to it. So hang with me. Boondock Saints cost $7 million to make back in 1999, which was a little more than $11 million had they been doing it today. And it unequivocally bombed at the box office, making $411,000 worldwide.
That's not very much.
No, in today's dollars, it's $650,000, which is far from $7 million that it costs to make. We're going to talk a whole lot about some of the craziness behind this movie, but that is literally the tip of the iceberg. What are your general thoughts on the movie?
Yes, general thoughts on this movie, Robbie.
Well, listen, this is a movie, and as A said, there are reasons why the box office was so good, and there's reasons why we're still talking about this, you know, more than 20 years later. Miramax Pictures, Harvey Weinstein, who we all know is a awful human being, he factors into the reason why, and the creator, the writer, the director, Troy Duffy, turns out he's about equal parts idiot and equal parts dick. So he's like an idiot.
Because of that,
everything went wrong with this production and no one wanted to help this movie out. Yeah. That's pretty much the reason why it did so poor.
My top level thoughts, babe, are, that's for those of you listening at home that I'm saying a babe, not Rob babe. Although Rob is a babe.
Is absolutely a babe.
He does flash
especially
his
Especially on St. Patrick's Day after a couple of shots of whiskey.
Speaking of which, I'm drinking a little Jameson today. Robbie, what you drinking?
Oh, I'm actually also, I'm drinking Jameson, but a mixed drink.
Oh, there you go.
I call an old-fashioned Irish breakfast because it's just essentially a whiskey old-fashioned, but I ran out of simple syrup, so I used maple syrup. So it's now an Irish breakfast. So cheers.
It's for the Irish Canadians in the house.
That actually sounds pretty delicious, I'm not going to lie.
It's actually quite good. A little black cherry on top.
I thought you were going to say that you cracked an egg into it like Rocky. That's why it's an Irish breakfast. No.
But before we move on with the details of the actors and all that other stuff, I do want to come back to this idea that there were 1,000 things that made this movie should have been forgettable, including it was rightfully so wildly panned by critics, critics small and large, college level critics, expert critics, Times, Roger Ebert. Everybody hated this movie with lots of good reason. And then when it went into video back in the day, it went into video right. Blockbuster Video made it an exclusive to Blockbuster release and put it on a shelf in every store they had. And in 6 months, it made $260 million.
Hello.
Maybe not in 6 months. It's made $260 million. But in 6 months, it earned back all of its money and the investment that Blockbuster made in it.
Is that money from Blockbuster because of Blockbuster buying copies or that and people saying, now I got to have my own copy of this?
No, back in the day, I worked for Blockbuster when this movie came out and you could buy a new release, but it was somewhere in the vicinity of $222.
Yeah, they were
and
really
I have no idea why they picked that price point, but a brand new release in its first 30 days was $222 to purchase the videotape, including if you lost it. Yeah, it was insane.
Oh my gosh.
And that's why you put your credit card down when there were still Blockbuster stores in case you didn't bring it back or in case you decided to tell me it got damaged. Like, I could price it out, but most people, they just wanted to keep the movie. And then they had to pay $122 or $222.
We are going to now dive into the cast. Before that, my general overview, my favorite part of this movie, I think I timed it out roughly the first 17 minutes.
Yeah.
The amount of small foreshadowings and hints that Duffy, a scriptwriter, puts in that later only makes sense after another two or three things happen to put it together. If you just focus on that beginning sequence through the start of Willem Dafoe analyzing the initial crime scene, it's really, really good. For a guy like me who writes fiction, where I want to drop a bunch of little things that you don't realize are going to stitch themselves together, like you know, cells coming together to form a larger organism, until you see the whole organism and go, oh, okay, well, all, and then there is a certain delight to seeing the part self-assemble later on. And for whatever you say about the rest of this movie, that opening segment is just awesome.
Well, and there's an argument to be made that the initial, we'll talk about this a little later in the show, but the initial overnight success and the bidding war, but the intense interest in this script was probably because the first 20 pages read really well.
Yeah. Okay.
And they did. I mean, I think that makes sense. But we should start to talk maybe about
let's go to the cast.
Casting crew. This is actually not in the cast. This is the man himself.
Yeah. So that's Troy Duffy, who essentially was a bartender in Los Angeles. And he had this idea of a story, and some things came together, including he saw a drug dealer steal money from a dead guy on the street when he was working as a bartender. And that led into the idea of, you know, the brothers stealing the money from the Russians, right? In addition to that, the opening scene when they're in the church and they're talking about Kitty Genovese, right? And this is a kind of a famous urban legend. Kitty Genovese was a woman who was raped and murdered in New York in the 60s, right? Mm-hmm. And the Times came out and said like 38 neighbors watched it all happen and none of them did anything. Now, that is a huge over-exaggeration. Okay. Multiple people called the police. Multiple people heard it but didn't see it. They just thought it was a drunk couple arguing, that kind of stuff. An old woman actually came down and held Kitty as she died before the ambulance got there. All this kind of stuff. But those ideas of good people doing nothing while bad stuff was happening is where Troy Duffy gets the idea for this movie. And it is, this is at the time, think about it, late 90s, everybody's looking for the next Tarantino, right? They want that auteur. They want to give him a whole bunch of money to do his vision the way Tarantino did. So Troy Duffy started thinking, well, my farts don't stink. Everybody wants me, right? And eventually it came down to a bidding war. Harvey Weinstein works with Miramax. They give him $300,000 for this script. They tell him that he will have total control and he can direct it himself. They also buy him the bar that he is working at the time in order to grab hold of this script. And that's how the whole thing started.
Yep. And that's, he's actually supposed to co-own the bar with Harvey Weinstein, which in 1999 in L.A., there is maybe no bigger chip to show around town then you co-own a thing with Harvey Weinstein.
Sure.
He's that cool with you. He bought a bar for you to share, which was the idea.
And this of course being before we all understood that Harvey Weinstein was one of the worst human beings in the history of man at the time. He was just a huge name.
He was the man at the time.
And it's an interesting thing because that specific story that Rob just told is true. All of that actually went into play. Mm-hmm. And we will find out later, none of it actually came to fruition because of how big of a jerk Troy Duffy was.
Suits Clash personalities.
This goes on and on, and we'll talk about this a lot. I'll try to stop saying it, but Troy is so problematic that they start with a $15 million budget. So he's going to get $300,000 just for the script. He's going to get a 50% ownership in a bar in L.A., which is now the most famous bar in L.A. for the moment. And he's going to get a $15 million budget to make his small thing.
Okay.
And he's such a jerk about it. He can't get any like big name stars. We'll talk about this again. Like he literally like trashes Brad Pitt and Matt Damon, who both have interest in the script.
Sure, of course Matt Damon has interest in it, yeah.
And refuses to even meet with them.
Wow.
And then he actually ends up getting when it comes down to it, the movie gets made with a $5 million budget and he lands Sean Patrick Flannery to be Connor.
Okay.
Connor McManus. And I absolutely adore this. At the time that Sean Patrick Flannery joins this cast, he has already been Powder, which makes him a big star, a world famous property, even though he doesn't look quite the same. And he has been young Indiana Jones. And young Indiana Jones is a thing he does for years. He's the middle age. He's the 20 at the beginning. He's like the 20-year-old version of Indiana Jones, not the kid. And he does this, I don't know, 20 years throughout his career, as long as it takes to get there. But he's already been like a famous on TV, famous in the movie. So he actually looks like a pretty big get to me in this movie. And I think he does it because he loves the script and he loves the idea and he's an Irishman and all that, you know, he's of Irish descent and all that stuff. So he also, which I find fascinating, I'm not sure it was true at the time, but he is black belt Brazilian jiu-jitsu, I think.
Okay.
And he runs a Brazilian jiu-jitsu joint in LA to this day because he wanted world-class people to work out with. So I find like he took his time and energy from this, and he's still acting a prolific actor. What's so strange about this is he's fond of this, but he very rarely talks about Boondock Saints. Very rarely.
Very rarely.
Only when he's specifically talking about Boondock Saints.
And his BJJ black belt is from the Gracie. It's Gracie Academy. And back in 2008, that's pretty impressive. That if you guys don't know martial arts and combat, to be a black belt in anything is a serious accomplishment. And a black belt in BJJ from a Gracie related gym, he's not a man to be trifled with.
Yeah, and then he confirmed just recently, I think in 2017, that although he has a lot of love for Connor McManus, he will not come back for a Boondock 3.
Is Troy Duffy going to be? Are we going to get to the Boondock 3?
I don't think we'll ever get a Boondock 3. But I think part of the help in getting Troy Duffy to maybe come back to reality is Connor McManus slash Sean Patrick Flannery saying like, nope, I'm absolutely never doing this again.
And wait, McManus? That's Mick M. Anus. I never noticed that before.
Y'all don't get off the hook for Paul Schneider. Sorry, just don't.
Brings us to brings us to the second brother, Norman Penis. Reedus. Excuse me, Norman Reedus.
This is a serious film, you guys. Oh, wait, no, it's not. Go ahead.
No, it's not.
No, it's not. Go ahead. It's okay.
And of
nice
course,
try.
Norman Reedus has risen to huge, massive international fame as Daryl Dixon in The Walking Dead. But before then, he had been in... I didn't remember him in Mimic. Gosh darn, I've seen Mimic a couple times.
He would have been young then, too. I mean, not too young. He's just a couple years younger than this. But it's literally one of the very first things he does with...
Okay.
Which is amazing. Like, could you imagine like having the career Norman Reedus ends up having? Uh-huh. With your first movie being a Del Toro movie?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
if,
not bad.
If you're Troy Duffy, you think, well, of course, this is what I've always deserved. But can you imagine like a young actor just trying to be like, I'm from Florida, I'm trying to do the right thing. I am, wow.
It must have been just such a crappy experience that neither of them want to come back to this
And they don't talk about it.
Yeah,
and I, as A said.
Yeah, I actually wonder if part of it is, because if you look at their Twitter feeds, especially Norman Reedus, he will share everything that is a legitimate thing that Troy Duffy does. Like, oh, he co-wrote some of this, or oh, he helped did this. Mm-hmm. So I think it might be, and this is totally me pontificating, I think it might be that they are trying to get Troy Duffy to come back to reality and be sane, because he did have some good ideas. He just got so into his own head and his own ego. So I think they're trying to gently say like, okay, honey, come on. Nope.
Trying to bring it back. That's the brothers. And then Rob, we move into one of my second favorite actor in this movie. Billy Connolly is lights out in this thing.
That's Sir Billy Connolly. Thank you very much.
Yes,
Billy Connolly comes in and he plays the biggest heavy, right? The guy that can always take care of whatever problem. They get him out of jail just to take care of what the hell is going on, that none of the mafioso or none of the Russian mob actually know what the hell's going on here.
Okay.
They think it's the two mobs fighting it out, and then they realize that's not it at all. But Billy Connolly, he's this awesome actor, does a lot of comedy stuff, right? He's a comedian. He does stand-up. He does, you know, sitcoms, right? So for Duffy to cast him against type was about the happiest day in Billy Connolly's life. I mean, he loved every freaking minute of this, to the point where Duffy had to add that cigar when he's in the big shootout scene. There was a fire.
Go back.
When he's in that scene, Duffy had to put a cigar in Billy Connolly's mouth because he could not stop smiling. Yeah. He was smiling because he was having so much fun and playing a guy that's against everything he's ever done. He was like giddy about it, and they needed him to be menacing. And so they had to shove the cigar in his mouth just to get him to stop smiling. I mean, that's fantastic.
And Rob, just so you know, Scott has put up a picture of Billy Connolly as El Duce with the cigar in his mouth and the two pistols and the others in the holsters. Mm-hmm. Smiling his fool head
off. He's still smiling.
I mean, he's still smiling.
You know what? If you're going to kill people, why not enjoy your work?
I mean, if you're El Duce.
Enjoy your work.
Enjoy your work.
Listen, if you love what you do, you never work a day in your life. Right? So, and the cool thing about Billy Donnelly is I think, Scott, he would be like you would be if you were on a set. Like, in between takes, you would be doing, you know, a Baby McMuffin interviewing people. That's what you
I do love that you called him Baby McMuffin.
I called him Baby McMuffin. You know what I meant.
I know. Yes, I like
McButter.
It.
Butter. That's
I right? like it.
He was a set entertainer, right?
Yes, exactly right. He just basically, in between takes, would just roll out comedy bits. And he would have everybody, cast, crew, any random person walking by, laughing so much that at some point, Duffy would have to say, hey, Billy, we have to go to work now, okay? We have to make the scene now. And that was the coolest part, because that's just who Billy Connolly is.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's gone on to just he's done so many things, Lord of the Rings, animation, just great.
This is his first serious role. This really opened the door to a lot of that other serious stuff, because up to this point, nobody knew he could pull it off.
How interesting, we have two guys in the movie who don't even talk about it anymore, and one who probably can't talk about it enough. Which brings us to the incredible Willem Dafoe in this movie.
Wow.
And Willem, so many people were considered for this part. Patrick Swayze, Robert De Niro, Sir Kenneth Branagh, Kevin Spacey passed in the role, Miramax wanted Sylvester Stallone, Bill Murray, who would have been great, or Mike Myers. I'm not sure how well that would have worked out.
But they all three of those, Willem Dafoe,
yeah?
Yeah, yeah. All three of those that Miramax wanted, uh-huh, when Miramax was still involved, they had relationships with all three of those actors already.
I see.
So mm-hmm, it would have been like, oh, we understand the parameters here or whatever. But the first three you mentioned were interested in the part.
Okay.
And again, we'll talk a little bit about Troy Duffy's disinterest in somebody was not as famous or talented as he was at the time.
Oh, boy.
So that's maybe why he turned down, I don't know, Robert De Niro.
Yeah, Robert De Niro would have been a good choice. Defoe took this role after two decades of constant work, in part because, in his own words, he likes to take challenges. His performance as Paul Schmecker, not Schmall Pecker, has been called everything from uneven and eccentric to perfectly eccentric. And he's another just absolute legend of Hollywood. He's done
absolutely.
So much
stuff. Since then, in this movie, he is the only one who's an Oscar winner or a multiple Oscar winner. Mm-hmm. He's won BAFTAs. He's won Golden Globes. He's won all sorts of movie roles and TV shows and all of that. And he is in every role sort of a chameleon and mercurial. And I think that's part of what was so wonderful about this. There's also a rumor that he didn't get a ton of direction. So he's like, all right. I'm happy to do what you want.
Let me know when I cross the line. And apparently there was no line.
No line. Yeah.
Now, we are coming to our last cast member we're going to talk about. And I got to be honest, Rob, I'm not happy with you. David Della Rocca got to be in this movie for a specific reason. And I'm waiting for you to make a friggin' movie so I can be in it. What the hell, man?
So David,
and I will name the character Scott Carl Sigler. Yeah.
So David Della Rocca is a childhood friend of Troy Duffy's, and a lot of his character is written based on David Della Rocca. So his character name is also David Della Rocca. And
sorry about that. Go ahead.
And he was in Boondock Saints 2, and he's had a couple of other credits, and he's done some comedy since then. But pretty much, like, this is the defining role. Again, we'll talk a lot about, like, critics didn't have a lot of nice things to say about David Della Rocca's role. Mm-hmm. I find that totally a reasonable criticism. But also, if you're playing yourself or the person your lifelong friend thinks you're going to be, I'm sure that you just sort of fall into that. We see that a lot in Judd Apatow movies where people have worked together for years and years and years, and they just get into the camaraderie of doing their thing.
Okay.
And I think that David Della Rocca felt very comfortable. And to be fair,
he did a good job.
He did. Yeah. I mean, he's not a terrific actor, but he's a terrific actor in this movie playing himself, like a batshit crazy version of himself. Mm-hmm. But also, I'm pretty sure the human David Della Rocca has never had to deal with shooting a cat. And so, spoiler
That's
alert.
That's a big assumption. I'm just saying.
So, like, that is a thing that people, you know, actors train to do. So I appreciate the role that he had, like, the job that he did with the role that he had, considering acting not necessarily his gig. He did study acting for a while, so maybe he ended up not being a great actor. But I feel like it's a little harsh to dog him for this role because he's literally like, sure, Troy, whatever, I'll do it.
Well, this guy, when he comes on the scene in the movie, we're largely mostly past that first 17 minute segment, except for his role in the bar. And again, the first 17, 20 minutes, super tight. And then the scenes with him, most of the talking scenes with long held shots, those are where it gets janky. I think the action was pretty good, but it's the interaction between the characters where things are just kind of, nothing really clicks for me in that movie in those parts.
Yeah. And yet, I still love it.
Yeah,
like, I can call out all the things that are terrible about it, and really terrible performances, really terrible, not CGI, but effects, that sort of thing.
Yep.
But it still works for me.
In the climate-ravaged world of 2072, the city of Piura stands as a miraculous green haven. Piura is a geoengineered paradise that protects its fortunate residents from the global catastrophes of heat domes, fires, floods, and droughts. In a time when the world outside is unsafe, it's vital for Piura's existence that people rally behind the purpose of the city, and Demetria Lopez, head of the city's public relations, tirelessly promotes its idyllic image. But when she stumbles on a dark secret that, if exposed, would be the downfall of Piura's existence, she must decide who and what she's willing to protect. From Wondery, the makers of Academy and Dr. Death, The Last City stars actors Ray Seahorn, Jeannie Tirado, and Maury Sterling. Follow The Last City on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Last City early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored. Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
It's a movie made by extremely flawed people, mm-hmm. about extremely flawed people, that is extremely flawed, and yet so freaking entertaining.
So entertaining.
Right?
So entertaining. Yeah, it's really good.
So we should probably get into what we've been that. Toying around with this idea that this was such a crazy time for this film to get made. Rob, we mentioned that there's all sorts of, well, myth, backstory, all the stuff we've been talking about Troy Duffy. Do you want to, Weinstein, do you want to get into some of that?
Yeah. So, I mean, you think at the time, and completely unheralded, unproven auteur like Troy Duffy gets mm-hmm. the dream contract and partnership with Harvey Weinstein, right? I mean, that's fantastic. One of the biggest names in the business. And the problem is that Duffy kind of puts him off so early in their relationship that Weinstein just says, I'm done. He never actually says it. And Duffy always accused him of it and accused him of submarining it and trying to blackball him and screw up the movie, like from the get-go. And at the time, everybody was like, Harvey wouldn't do that. Harvey's all about the money.
He's
this
a, good
is a good
guy.
Movie. Yeah, right. What a heck of a guy. And then we find out as the years go on that, yes, he is a trash of a human being. He is awful, and everything he's done with the young women that he worked with and everything. All of a sudden, I look back now and say, yeah, I bet Harvey Weinstein did exactly what Troy Duffy said he did. I bet he submarined this movie. He downsold it at Cannes when it was first released, and that just really, you know, he's been known to threaten filmmakers and all this kind of stuff. So it seems like now, looking back, it would not be out of character at all for Weinstein. To just blacklist it, make sure it got screwed up. And if you look, there's this great documentary called Overnight that's about this. It's about the overnight success of Troy Duffy. And you see some of the behind-the-scenes stuff, and you see some of the conversations and the phone calls. And it's just like, yeah, I think Troy Duffy on this one, he's for the one time in the production of this movie, he's in the right. And
yeah,
I think Weinstein did everything Duffy said he did.
And like you mentioned, Overnight, if you guys are at all a fan of this movie, absolutely find that documentary and watch it. It makes mm-hmm. the movie so much better when you realize that they actually got it out and you actually got to watch it. It's mesmerizing. But yeah, he actually is, like, in that movie, you hear him completely unable to talk to Harvey Weinstein in a professional-to-professional way because he's so convinced that Weinstein is manipulating him. And, of course, now we know Weinstein was so invested in manipulating every single mm-hmm. piece of his career. Okay. That is probably mm-hmm. is true.
And so we have, obviously, Weinstein's proven to be a very difficult right. sort of individual. But Duffy, even though he may have been right about his experience, also a rather difficult individual.
Yes.
Rob, I mean, tell us about the casting process for this movie.
Yeah, if this is going to be Duffy's new job, he's terrible at it. He's really bad at putting casts together and making people. He misunderstands the fragile egos of people in Hollywood mm-hmm. and does not pussyfoot around them at all. He clashed with the producers. He clashed with Miramax. He clashed with everybody. Some actors that would have been great in these roles, Duffy wouldn't even meet with. I mean, Brad Pitt, Keanu Reeves. He called Keanu Reeves a punk. And after seeing Keanu Reeves with a pistol in his hand, I think that was a poor choice. He calls Ethan Hawke, who's one of the biggest names in Hollywood at the time, a talentless fool.
Wow.
So I want to compare Duffy to Tarantino, right? Because those are the two big auteurs of the 90s that we're talking about.
And clearly there's careers. A Tarantino influence on
100%,
Duffy. 100%.
Yeah, go ahead. No doubt about it. Tarantino valued and appreciated everything that came before him, and he paid homage to and worked with the biggest names from when he loved movies. And he made sure to bow down to them and let them know how much he loved their work. Duffy, on the other hand, does exactly the opposite. He thinks he's the big man and everyone should be bowing down to him.
Okay.
And that's why you look at Tarantino's IMDb page and there's 1,000 things on there. And you look at Troy Duffy and there's 12.
Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah.
And to all 12 come back to Boondock Saints pretty
to
much.
To use a curse word, if I may, mm-hmm. the old phrase, at least my dad taught me, and other people teach him, you don't shit where you sleep. Mm-hmm. And when you are, you know, taking a regular dump on other people, especially in a highly connected industry like the movie industry,
yep.
where you know cameras are on you and you're still saying these awful things about people that somewhere down the road, not only might you work with, but somewhere down the road, you being able to work with that person might be the thing that gets that project made.
For sure.
And he's just, you know, you're cutting off your nose for your face. You don't see the long tail of what your career is going
to
be.
Yeah, absolutely. And to Rob's point, the him calling Ethan Hawke a talentless fool and calling Keanu Reeves a punk, those are in overnight. You can hear him say it. It's not a rumor. He mm-hmm. says it. It's insane. And he's never met them. It's not he had a meeting with them and was like, nah, that guy is not right for the, he's a little bit of a punk. He's just talking off the top of his head. And I'm sure to this day, he has never met either one of those punks or talentless fools. However, he did meet Ewan McGregor, Rob.
This is such a great story. This is unbelievable to me. And honestly, I wish they had cameras on this. I would have loved to see this. So apparently he flies to New York, wants to meet Ewan McGregor, thinks he's going to be perfect for the role, which of course he would have been, no doubt about it. But Duffy starts drinking. And when he starts drinking, he starts arguing. And they get in this long, drawn-out verbal assault about the death penalty to the point where Ewan McGregor just basically says, screw you. I would never do a movie with you. And walks out the door. That's what we're talking about, right? And so with Weinstein hitting it from one end and Duffy screwing things up from the other end, Miramax pulls out. They said, we're done. We're not going to distribute this movie. We're not going to pay for the rest of it. Good luck. And so this little Franchise Pictures, which is just a little, you know, a little shop, says, okay, we will distribute it, but we have to own the rights after we put it in theaters.
Okay.
And Duffy at this point is desperate. He's like, well, if we get the movie out there, it's going to explode and everybody's going to love it. And so it won't matter. I'm not worried about the distribution after it's in theaters. Because the movie, the money from the theaters is going to be all I ever need, and I'll be set for life.
And that was not the case.
That was not the case. It's an interesting time, though, because we keep talking about this this documentary Overnight. One of the things that's important to note about Overnight is the people that so Duffy gets lead money when he signs with Miramax. And like Rob said, they put the movie into turnaround after about 3 months. Turnaround is saying like, hey, you guys, we're not going to ask you to pay us back for this, but we're done. Anybody want this? You can have this.
Somebody else can buy it from us, but we're not putting another dollar into this.
Right. And so they put it into turnaround. Eventually, somebody picks it up. But it goes from Duffy getting half ownership in a bar with Harvey Weinstein and $300,000 and a $15 million budget and A-list stars to a $5 million budget and a contract that egotistical Duffy doesn't even realize. In the world of Blockbuster Video in 1999, that's a huge thing. And he doesn't even realize that he's not negotiating those rights. That's how egotistical and sure he is that it won't matter. And of course, that's not what happens. So Tony Montana and Mark Brian Smith are the people who created Overnight. And at the time, they were hired because they were the band managers for Troy Duffy's band, which we haven't mentioned until now.
Did Troy Duffy hire them to make Overnight?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
And
I know. It's great.
and excuse me, and they go into this thinking like awesome because this is a crazy, and at the time I can't remember what it was called, but it wasn't called Overnight.
Okay.
And they go like, this is insane. He gets he gets to be the composer for the movie. His band, which at the time was called, I think, the
Brood.
The Brood. Thank you. It's called The Brood. There's already a famous band with albums out in 1999 in somewhere else in the world called The Brood. And so whoever controls this, I'm assuming also Miramax, is like, cool, you can't be The Brood. And he's like, fuck that. We're going to be The Brood anyway. And he's like, cool, we're not going to do it. They they renamed the band the Boondock Saints, which I guess they were until 2007 when they sort of broke up.
Okay.
Duffy's brother is in the band.
All right.
And as part of this deal, he gets to... compose the any of the music in the show. The Boondock Saints get to be the band in the show, and his brother is in the band, and they get paid for that, like industry scale. And Duffy keeps it for himself. It's his own brother, two people who are making the documentary about Troy Duffy, he refuses to pay any money to.
Well, and that brings up Troy Duffy saying he thought the treatment in the movie, his treatment in the movie, was extremely unfair. He says, did I think it was fair? He says, absolutely not. I don't have to feel. I know I was there. It was happening to me. That kind of behavior you saw in that film was the exception and not the rule. And I don't think it was too fair of them to not provide any context of why Troy's upset, who's talking to, etc. You know what? You don't shit where you sleep, and you don't not pay the people making a documentary about you. It's never going to go well.
And Tony Montana and Mark Brian Smith have had many interviews about this and said, like, trust us, this wasn't an inside job. We literally made him out to be the best version of himself. Yeah. And they say this with proof. We didn't add all the anti-Semitism.
Oh, my God.
We didn't add all the homophobia.
Oh,
we didn't add all the racism. We didn't add all that, but we have all that. And all of a sudden, Troy Duffy is no longer saying that it was a con job.
And the best part of the whole documentary is, you know, Boondock Saints is completely panned. I mean, it's got a low number on Rotten Tomatoes. All the critics hated it, right? Mm-hmm. Overnight is a huge media darling, right? The critics love it. The fans love it. It has a huge rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Everybody loves this documentary. Except, of course, Troy Duffy.
And, you know, the crazy thing about this, and I don't know a lot of these details, but so this movie comes out the Boondock Saints comes out in 1999, after 10 years in development of all this business and drama of Miramax coming in and going out and all that stuff.
Yeah, that's when it was first at Cannes to try to get sold.
Yeah, and then in 2004, Overnight comes out. And then I think it's in 2007 or 9 or something. Duffy gets Boondock 2 made. I find that amazing. How many times do you have to be shown that this won't work?
I often compare working in Hollywood, which we haven't done yet, but we study it enough, or writing a book a lot, to being a head coach in the NFL or a coach in the NFL. Once you have attained that level, even if your team goes 0-16, 1-15, once you've been a head coach in the NFL, you always have work. There's always somebody who will hire you at some level of football, probably pro football, because you have experience that is untouchable anywhere else. And that's why so many people, aspiring filmmakers, set out to make that they burn credit cards or do everything they can to get that indie made. Joseph Kahn is one of those who went over a million in debt just to make his first movie. Because once you've made a movie and show people you can do the whole process, you are a far, even if you're an asshole, you're much less of a risk when it comes to people. Here's $5 million. Prove you want to give that $5 million to somebody who's already shown they can make a product and generate a profit or at least revenue. That's how, you know, so yeah, I'm surprised he hasn't made more, to tell you the truth.
Well, and I think that has a lot to do with his inability to get over his own ego. I think that people, I mean, it's proof in the pudding that Willem Dafoe makes an uncredited cameo in Boondock 2. Sean Patrick Flannery and Norman Reedus are back as the McManus brothers.
Okay.
And I think that stands to the idea that if he could get out of his... I mean, honestly, and I'm not putting anything on him or anything, but honestly, I think there are people who care about him and think he could be talented if he could solve this mania of his ego or whatever. So I think he could work more if he was a little less
Also, unfortunate timing that helped sink this movie.
For sure.
Right? So it premieres at Cannes 1 month after the Columbine shootings.
Okay.
In 1999, right? So two white kids walking around in black clothing with weapons shooting people. All of a sudden, the distributors all backed off. They're like, I am not attaching my name, my company's reputation to this movie. It's too violent. It's too soon. We can't do it. And that's why there was really only one production company that was willing to distribute it and only willing to distribute it for a very small window. And that was just a huge part of it. I mean, timing in Hollywood's everything, right?
That absolutely matters. This is a great point. I love this. The amount, talking about what a difficult person Sean Duffy is, the amount of violence in the script made almost made it almost impossible for the filmmakers to find a church that would allow them to shoot in the premises. The church where the brothers attend mass in the opening scene is Boston's Union United Methodist Church. Duffy also allegedly received a letter from the Archdiocese of Toronto that detailed the church's hatred of the film and called Duffy the spawn of Satan.
Now, here's the problem. You've
got the church calling you the spawn of Satan. That's impressive.
And isn't that Catholic the best church. Marketing you could possibly have if you're going to write a movie like The Boondock Saints? And instead of leaning in, he's offended.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I would roll with that all day. That would be the
Archdiocese of Toronto calls you the spawn of Satan for making The Boondock Saints, and that doesn't show up in your media? What?
Yeah, you would put that quote on the back of one of your books, wouldn't you, Scott?
I'd replace the title of my book with that. That would be the title of the book.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be Scott Sigler, New York Times bestseller. It would be Scott Sigler, who the Archdiocese of Toronto called the spawn of Satan.
Exactly. We do have to talk about, there is one other actor in this movie that I want to mention. He's got a very small role. Make all the jokes you want once I tell you that that person I'm talking about is Ron Jeremy.
He is not Paul Smecker.
No, he is not Paul Smecker. He does have
this
a very...
This is why I hang out with Rob, you guys. That was well done.
I'm getting you guys ready. I'm set. Here's one more softball.
Go ahead.
He does have a very small part. But I wanted to point out another, since we're talking about overnight and how... for me, anyway, it's so much more interesting to watch The Boondock Saints if I've watched overnight. There is a documentary called Porn Star, The Legend of Ron Jeremy. And, of course, the hedgehog is having the same sort of trouble that Harvey Weinstein is having
now.
Yes,
he is.
That said, so I'm not necessarily officially recommending Porn Star as a view, but I will say when you watch it, Ron Jeremy in The Boondock Saints is absolutely straight acting. There is nothing about him. Even when he goes to the peep show, there is nothing about him that is capitalizing on the fact that he's a porn star. He is showing up to do his
work. I thought he did a good job.
And years ago saw a porn star in The Legend of Ron Jeremy. I think it came out in 2000 or 2001, a while back.
Okay.
And it's fascinating because he's this good nebbishy Jewish kid in this iteration back then who just wants to make it in the movies and literally sees himself doing porn until he becomes a movie star.
And this
makes his big break.
He has crossed over a bunch of times.
And every chance that somebody wants to take him seriously, he does it. And you actually see in that documentary about him, you see him packing his luggage to go for a shoot and a part that he really... And I don't think it's this movie. But he's also like this I guess his parents were Depression era, and his luggage is, I kid you not, trash bags. Because he's so I just want to go do the work, and this is every single thing, like the Boondock Saints tiny role that he had there, he treats as if it's going to make him a legitimate star. That's and great. I find that kind of bittersweet and sad.
And Troy Duffy makes an appearance in Ron Jeremy's Porn Star documentary. He talks about Ron Jeremy, the actor, in that documentary. So yeah. It's interesting. So I want to touch upon, guys. So we talked about the blockbuster thing and how this movie made hundreds of millions of dollars and how Duffy essentially didn't get any of it. And so how did a sequel get made? It's because Duffy sued Franchise Pictures.
Okay.
Right?
Wow.
Basically said, yeah, I know I signed that contract, but apparently I was an idiot. And I should get some of the money from Blockbuster. And when it came down to it, Franchise, as oft happens with bigger companies, just said, fine, give him some money. Let's settle. Let's get out of this. And so he ended up making money from the Blockbuster deal that made this such a, you know, a blockbuster, if you excuse the pun, box office, right? The hundreds of millions of dollars. He got his slice of that pie and then turned around, used a bunch of that money to help greenlight Boondock Saints 2, All Saints Day, and that's really how the second movie got made.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Has he done other movies besides these two?
He has done a few little writing parts, and there's one other movie. I forget what it's called, but it's not... This is his entire career. His entire career is proving that he was...
Yeah, he's done some episodic TV.
Yeah.
He's done a few things that no one's ever heard of. And I mean,
and most of his career is trying to prove that he was railroaded and is the star he believes himself to be.
Is he still at the bar? Does anybody know he still has the bar?
No, he never got the bar because he burned that relationship with Miramax, so they never finished the deal.
Okay.
So and director, of course, Harvey Weinstein didn't want to own a dive bar in L.A.
He was attached to a TV series called Luminous, which I don't know if that got made or, but that's back in 2015. So his IMDb credits as a director, The Boondock Saints 2. That's all we've got.
Yeah.
That's all we've got. That's
pretty much it. Yeah.
And, you know, the shame of it is he had the chops to make a script that absolutely had a ton of interest. And so theoretically, even though he wants to be, essentially he wants to be Clooney, I guess. He wants to act when he wants to act. He wants to direct when he wants to direct. He wants to produce when he wants to produce. Mm-hmm. What he is, if he's anything, is a writer. And if he could get out of his head and write, I bet he could do just fine and have a career. But he wants to be the big kahuna, and
listen,
I don't think that's going to happen.
This script is awesome.
Yeah.
Right? It's great. I mean, the way that they first show the end of the scene, right? And then they have FBI agent Paul Smecker describe what he thinks happened. And he's really good at this. And he is dead on with some of the stuff. And then they flash back and show what happens. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is directly to the detail that Paul Smecker said it was going to be. I mean, that's clever.
It's wonderful.
I've never really seen
it
done that way before. It's clever.
Mm-hmm. It is, yeah. And I do, I think that there is some magic that exists, like in Trolls 2, for example, like the other movies that for all the right reasons failed as a movie making endeavor. Mm-hmm. And then for all the right reasons, succeeded with the at-home audience that had, because I think that those are different experiences. And back in 99 and early 2000s, that's when we're starting to see the difference between going to watch a movie in the cinema with your friends versus the experience you can have at home. And those movie tastes start to change. Like, well, I'll see that one on the big screen, but I'll see these others. And I think that that's part of the reason that Boondock Saints succeeds is because it's a movie you can watch on your TV at home and love.
Yeah,
and a bit of a you don't want other people to know that's the type of movie you rented, right? I mean, you know, the kind that used to be behind the little curtain and the little door that often had Ron Jeremy them. That was one kind, but also the ones that, like, you know, you want people to think you're watching Citizen Kane. You know, you want people to think that you're watching these epics like Ben Hur, and instead, you know, you're renting Weekend at Bernie's 2. So it's a guilty pleasure kind of movie, and that's why I think it found such a great audience.
It did.
And it's a pretty good movie. I mean, overall, it's fun to watch. We rewatched it for this. It's got plenty of flaws, like most movies do, but it's a very, very fun movie. And Willem Dafoe, if you were If you just add him in it, it would be outstanding. And then you've got all the other stuff on top of it.
I will mention, in case you guys are listening, I'll put this in the show notes as well for the podcast when it happens. But if you are hearing this, I put in the chat room a link to an article, to a review of the Boondock Saints from back in the day that I love for all the same reasons that I love this movie. Mm-hmm. This guy pulls no punches. He literally says his opening line is, "What's so incredible about the Boondock Saints is how David Della Rocca's atrocious performance distracts from many other terrible things going on in the movie." Like, what?
It's not nice. It's not nice at all. Nelson in the chat room has pointed out that overnight, you can see it on Pluto TV for free, and I'm sure you can find it.
Yeah, I think it's
well.
On nice. Maybe. So there's one. Yeah, you can see it in a handful of places.
Before
so
we close out this show, the most important stats, of course, to me are the swear.
This is why I was waiting for you to hit these last two, Scotty.
The most important part about this movie, the word fuck and its derivatives are used a total of 246 times. That's a good number. I've kept tabs in a lot of movies with a lot of curse words, and that's a solid, solid number. And the body
count. David Della Rocca, I believe, does seven of those in one sentence. And that's pretty impressive.
Know, one of my best friends, Allison, and it's in one of your books.
It's in one of my books.
Allison and I used to run a business together when Scott and I started to work together, and she was mad about something on the phone, and we were in San Diego. He was still living in San Francisco, in the office in San Diego, and she's on the phone mad about something, and she hangs up. Because she's ever the professional. And she goes, "You know, fuck that guy and his fucking fucker." And we're both are like, "What?
It's in a book.
Again, Connor.
As Connor McManus says to David right after that sentence, mm-hmm. Shows the diversity of the word.
Absolutely.
The body count in this movie, 33, which I felt it was higher, but 33 is pretty good body count.
Surprisingly low, isn't it?
34 if you count the cat.
Yeah. Yeah.
There you go. If you,
and I did accidentally, as I was calling up graphics for the live stream, did have a picture of a cat on a stove burning come across the screen. So it could be very well be that cat. Now, but as we go into the closing, we were going to do Coming to America 2 for the next movie. But I have to point out here, I think I can do it like a little bit like this.
Where did the fans come in on that?
I threw a quick poll out to Cigarette Junkies, which is a private group over on Facebook. If you're a fan of mine and you've not gone to facebook.com/group/Cigarette Junkies, one word, and you have to apply to get in. They don't just take anybody. What I rattled out to the crowd there, and it's, let's get an update on the stats real quick. And it was a clear win. People want to see, query error.
Oh, added one more.
We have got 61 votes for Coming to America and 4 votes for Coming to America 2. It is decided.
Yeah.
It is decided. So the fans are
decided. My guess is we'll do both. Not together, but at some point we'll also, later this year, probably review Coming to America 2.
All right.
Coming to America.
Rob, coming to America.
Rob, do you have any last closing thoughts on this movie?
Listen, go in understanding that it's a very flawed movie and that Willem Dafoe is completely over the top.
Completely.
And just embrace it. Love it. Hold it close to you late at night and just understand that's what the movie is. And you will have a hell of a good time, especially around St. Patrick's Day.
Yes, okay. Yes. Baby, any last thoughts?
Oh, yeah. That's one other thing I don't think I said on the cast, but when we were setting up, I think it's this article maybe that I posted and I just mentioned. I read sometime in the prepping for this show, he mentions, I can't believe you open the movie with a scene on St. Patrick's Day in Boston, in Southie, and there's no St. Patrick's Day parade at all.
None.
I mean, you can buy that footage. Probably free. Probably somebody give it to him for free. None of that. It's just a scene in a bar, which is great, with lots of nice little notes. Doc, who owns the bar, has Tourette's, and everybody knows it except for the newcomers, and they sass him, but it's all good. And one little streamer, one little green streamer. Doesn't even say Paddy's Day. It's insane. That's my final thought.
My final thoughts on this movie is, if you've never seen it, it is definitely wonderful after 10 o'clock p.m. on a weeknight or weekend. You know, you've had a couple of drinks or whatever. A
couple shots of whiskey? Hell yeah.
Shots of whiskey. Actually, I have a couple shots of whiskey while you watch the film. If you like shoot 'em ups, if you like explosions, if you like dudes having war with criminals, you can't go wrong with this. It's fabulous. And the Green Goblin is in it, so it's everything I could want.
Fair enough.
I could want in a movie.
Fair enough.
All right, baby,
thank you
out.
So much, Rob, for joining us. Woo-hoo. We will see you when we do Coming to America in a couple of weeks.
Yep, sounds good.
Sounds great.
I'll let you know if there's a spoon with my soup.
All right, Rob.
See you.
Good day,
thank
sir.
You.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, I believe that we're done, right?
Yes, ma'am. We are done. Take us out.
So that was episode 67 of Story Smack. You can find Scott and I online. Scott is at Scott Sigler on Twitter and Instagram. And his Facebook page is facebook.com/Scott Sigler. I am at A Real Girl on Twitter and at a.real.girl on Instagram.
You can find us online at facebook.com/StorySmack. We live stream Story Smack every other Saturday at facebook.com/ScottSigler, twitch.tv/ScottSigler, and youtube.com/ScottSigler, where you can not only hear our voices, you can see all of our pretty faces as we jibber-jab about movies.
And had you been watching instead of listening to this, you would see the glorious hat.
You'd see my tiny hat.
Wearing.
I have a very tiny hat. That
very tiny.
My tiny hat has mystified the audience as to how this tiny hat is staying on my head. And I've explained to people in the chat room, it is the gravitational pull of my oversized melon.
I see.
Yes.
In addition to Story Smack, we do a once weekly live stream called Sigler in Place. It's on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. all through until everything the pandemic's over and we're done with lockdown. Right here, wherever you're watching this.
And I put out a section of a unabridged full-length audiobook every Sunday over at scottsigler.com. You can subscribe to that at scottsigler.com/subscribe. We got links to Spotify, iHeartRadio, and all the stuff.
And we hope you can join us to hear Scott's books and more Story Smack's goodness in the future. And I think that's it for us. Until the next episode, we will talk to you all
real soon.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to season one, we are thrilled to announce the launch of season two. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make season two even more memorable together.